Chapter 7 Christmas Eve. Each year, as the days grow shorter in England, where I now make my home, I cannot help but miss the winters of my childhood appallingly more than half a century ago in Upper Westchester, New York. Our home on a cul-de-sac at the top of a hill was surrounded by trees, which, by early December, were almost always laden with snow. The ponds and lakes would begin to freeze over, and the woods around us became studies in hard black and soft white, making them wonderfully mysterious and therefore more inviting than ever. I loved everything about winter, and I loved Christmas in particular. Our Christmases were joyous celebrations that to this day I still attempt to recreate. Although my parents' funds were limited, they made sure that our house was always elegantly decorated. My father had constructed a modernist manger out of scraps of walnut wood, in which sat contemporary figures of Mary, Joseph, and the Christ child. Over the years, other more traditional store-bought versions of shepherds, wise men, and farm animals somehow made their way into our Gropius-inspired stable, but they always seemed to me to be unsophisticated interlopers. Each year, when this homemade presepio, Italian for creche, the Christmas tree lights, the large primary-colored hand-painted variety, the stockings, and other decorative holiday bric-a-brac were freed from their crumbling cardboard boxes, I felt an almost overwhelming surge of joy. I knew that Christmas would transport us out of the prescribed, the mundane, and into a week or so of undefined days filled with endless play. As an Italian Catholic family, though very unpracticing, we ate only fish on Christmas Eve. Homemade food from recipes passed down over many generations was our daily fare. But during Christmas, this practice was elevated to even greater traditional culinary heights. It's believed that the serving of fish on Christmas Eve comes from the Roman tradition of not eating meat the night before a feast day. In some families, this meal is called the Feast of the Seven Fishes, but no one is quite sure why there are seven, other than it is the most used number in the Bible. At any rate, at least seven types of fish were served in my home on Christmas Eve when I was a kid. My mother would prepare a meal similar to the one that follows. Appetizers. Shrimp cocktail. Baked clams. Seafood ceviche. Stuffed mushrooms. Tzeipoli. First course. Salt cod with potatoes, green olives, and tomato. Pasta with tuna sauce. Second course. Baked salmon or baked bluefish with breadcrumbs, roasted potatoes, green beans, broccoli di rapa, green salad. Dessert, ice cream, biscotti, apple pie, panettone, nuts, and dried figs. The above is not an exaggeration. It was also only for five people, my parents, my two sisters, and myself. Over the years, with the inevitable addition of spouses, children, friends, etc., the number of dishes stayed the same, but the amount of food increased. Allow me to focus on one dish from each course, beginning with tzeipole. Tzeipole, or zeppole, as they are often pronounced by Italian Americans, are deep-fried, loosely shaped rings or balls of dough made from mashed-up potatoes and wheat flour. They can also be made with only wheat flour. When fried in very hot olive oil, they instantly puff up and become addictively delicious. Whenever my mother would begin to fry them, the whole family would unconsciously start edging more and more closely to the stove until we were all huddled around her, practically panting with the hunger we didn't know we had until she started cooking. After the tzeipole have fully puffed and are golden brown, they are plucked out and set aside to cool. As soon as they've cooled enough to handle, they are then devoured by anyone who can grab one the quickest. Because my father had very calloused hands from years of sculpting and working with solvents, he was able to snatch the hottest and freshest of the batch. As children, we tried to do the same, but it was of no use. Our soft palms and delicate fingertips couldn't handle the heat of those golden, doughy parcels, and we were therefore forced to wait for them to cool as we watched my father try to practically swallow his whole. We did, however, take great comfort in the fact that he would inevitably burn his tongue or his mouth in his eagerness and greed. My mother still makes tzeipole today in a small black frying pan that she inherited from her mother. She uses this priceless battle-scarred relic solely for Tzepoli and another favorite finger food, pitti fritti. Though not part of the Christmas Eve feast, the latter are worth mentioning here. Pitti fritti are palm-sized fritters made from leftover pizza dough. They are fried in olive oil, like Tzepoli, left to cool for a moment, dipped in sugar, and eaten by everyone and anyone who is nearby, especially children. When making pizza, I often reserve some of the dough and keep it in the fridge overnight so I can make them for breakfast. As I said, they can be served with sugar, but they're also a perfect partner to a fried egg. Fry the egg in extra virgin olive oil so that the edges of the egg are crispy but the yolk still soft. Place on top of the pitti fritti and add salt and pepper to taste. But let's return to the tzepoli. Another way of making them is to place a couple of anchovies in the dough as you are shaping it. I remember the first time I tried these as a very young boy and was completely repelled by the potency of the anchovies. But once I was in my teens and my palate had become more accepting of stronger flavors, I would patiently wait for those tzepoli that my mother or grandmother had filled with anchovies. But honestly, both versions are incredibly Moorish. Last summer, I suddenly had a craving for tzepoli, so I tried making them a couple of times, but they were not turning out properly. They weren't puffing up enough, or at all, and basically were just sort of leaden. After a second failed attempt, I was loath to throw away the dough that I had worked so hard to make, so I decided to shape it into a small round pizza of sorts and bake it in the outdoor oven. To my amazement, it puffed up beautifully and, even though I prefer my pizza thin, was absolutely delicious. The potato gave it an added depth and a billowy softness. I love potato bread, but this was quite different. I then started experimenting with different toppings, sautéed peppers and goat's cheese, sautéed onions, all of which perfectly complemented the dough. With any of these toppings, a green salad and a good beer, were it offered to me as lunch or dinner, I wouldn't turn it down. The next Christmas Eve dish that was and remains one of my favorites is bacalao. Bacalao is dried salted cod that has been preserved by, well, drying and salting it, a process that has been used for millennia. Though cod comes from cold northern seas, it has found its way into the cuisine of cultures all over the world. The reason for this is that this method of preservation made it possible for it to be transported in large quantities over great distances, allowing it to be sold and traded. At one time, cod was so plentiful, it was said that off the coast of Nova Scotia, people could walk across the water on the backs of this coveted fish. Unfortunately, due to overfishing, its numbers have dwindled, to say the least. Hence the rather high price it commands at fishmongers the world over. Leading up to Christmas Eve, as had been done for centuries, my mother would reconstitute the cod by soaking it in water for a day or so. It was then rinsed to remove the excess saltiness and slowly cooked in a very light tomato sauce with potatoes and green olives. Drizzled with extra virgin olive oil and served with a piece of toasted bread, or fiscotto, like most simple peasant dishes, it is probably one of the healthiest things one can ingest. Fiscotto, or biscotto, means twice cooked in Italian. The first spelling is the Calabrese pronunciation. It is stale bread that is slowly baked at a very low temperature for a few hours. The result is a hard, toast-like bread that will keep for a long period of time in a tin. The slow baking releases the sugars and gives it a gentle sweetness. It can be eaten with any kind of cheese or roasted peppers or broken up into smaller pieces and dropped into soups or whatever. After the cod and the other first-course dishes, there were so many I once suggested my parents build a vomitorium, came the main course. This was often a broiled bluefish. Bluefish is not commonly eaten, as most people find it oily and, quote-unquote, fishy. It's not as oily as mackerel, and its meat is lighter and flakier, but it's in the same family. However, if it's cooked properly, both of those qualities are tempered. It is also rather bony, which always put me off as a kid, but the taste was so hard to resist that I would steadily pick my way through my portion, much to my parents' dismay, with my bony little hands. The preparation for this dish is very simple. The fish is cut in half lengthwise and sprinkled liberally with a mixture of breadcrumbs, olive oil, a little chopped garlic, chopped parsley, and salt, on top of which a few thinly sliced lemon rounds are laid. It is then placed on a baking tray, loosely covered in foil, and put in the oven to bake at 325 degrees Fahrenheit. After about 20 minutes to half an hour, the foil is removed and the oven is switched to broil, grill if you're British, still confusing for me to this day, and the fish is cooked for about 5 minutes to crisp and brown the top and then left to rest for a few minutes. Now, as you know, whenever you cook fish, your kitchen will smell like, well, fish. And when you cook blue fish, it will smell even more like fish. Not like a fish that has gone off, but just more. But don't let this stop you from trying it. I promise that the delicate breadcrumb mixture and the acidity of the lemon work perfectly to nullify this particular poisson's pungency, giving it an almost sweet flavor. Over the years, my parents and I would take turns hosting Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. If I were hosting Christmas Eve, I would make some of the appetizers mentioned previously, but because I didn't have the time or, frankly, the inclination to devote myself to equaling my mother's staggering output, I would just make a huge pot of fish stew with at least 7 types of seafood. I would serve it with toasted bread or sometimes use it as a sauce with pasta, usually spaghetti or linguine. It is still one of my favorite dishes to make whenever I have guests. The beauty of it is that you can use almost any type of seafood with the exception of a very oily fish, like mackerel, sardines, or salmon. It takes no time at all to cook, and unless someone is allergic to shellfish, it's always a hit. In England, serving fish on Christmas Eve is not a tradition, but I still try to make at least 2 or 3 fish dishes when that night rolls around. I find them necessary light precursors to the very meat-heavy Christmas and Boxing Day meals that are soon to come. The Christmases that I have shared with my in-laws here in England are like so many I have experienced all my life. The day is filled with gift-giving, wine-pouring, game-playing, and, new to me, Christmas cracker pulling. It is, however, the food that differs most from my family's Christmas Day fare, but luckily, it is equally delicious, my mother-in-law Joanna being an excellent cook. There are hors d'oeuvres like devils on horseback, dates wrapped in bacon and broiled to a light crisp, and tiny sausages, both of which disappear down our throats within minutes on little rivers of champagne. Unlike in an Italian meal, there is no first course, but the food is bountiful. British-style roasted potatoes, steamed vegetables, and a bowl of mush called bread sauce. Bread sauce is very white bread soaked in milk, which looks and tastes like something Mr. Bumble and his ilk would have given to workhouse boys or toothless Victorian pensioners. I love everything else, but it's just not my favorite. All of these accompany a main course, which is always a grand piece of meat. Years ago, it would have been a turkey, but since my arrival into the family and the introduction of an American Thanksgiving into the calendar, we have all decided that 2 turkeys in a month is a bit redundant on the palate. Therefore, the roast beast taking center stage is either a 3-bird roast, in America it's called a turducken or gooducken, which consists of either a deboned chicken stuffed inside a deboned duck, stuffed inside a deboned turkey or goose, respectively, a baked ham, a standing rib of beef, or a big fat goose all on its own. I love them all, as does everyone at the table, hence very little is left at the end of the meal. New and very welcome to my taste buds on my first British Yuletide was the classic English Christmas Day dessert, sticky toffee pudding. I'm not one for sweets, but for some reason, I find this very hard to resist, especially with a glass of good port that my father-in-law generously serves at the end of the meal. After this feast, we are all well-sated, and as I listen to the British accents of my family, I wonder what Christmas would have been like here in days of old. I imagine donning my frock coat and top hat, wrapping my long woolen scarf around my neck, bidding farewell to my in-laws, and strolling home with my family through snowy streets lined with Georgian homes, the smoke of the coal fires within wafting from their chimneys as we make our way to the Cratchit house to check just once more on dear sweet Tiny Tim. However, my Hollywood version of jolly old England is decimated when I open the door of my in-law's home and see it is not snowing but raining again, or still. The children are crying because they are leaving their grandparents, apparently forever, in their minds. And we make our way into the driveway, wrestle them into their car seats as the older kids somehow squeeze into any empty space available, and cautiously drive the 1 mile back home before 2-year-old Amelia's chronic car sickness causes her to vomit all over herself. Talk about Dickensian. Christmas Day. Christmas mornings with 3 small children, as anyone will know who has 3 small children, are at once heartwarming and exhausting. Upon far too early an awakening, Kate and I would have to stop the kids from going after their gifts like velociraptors attacking their prey. I always kept large plastic bags at the ready and would fill them with the shredded wrapping paper as soon as it was rent from the presents by their desperate little hands. This is to ensure that tidiness is maintained and that no present gets lost or discarded accidentally under what will soon be mounds of paper. I once threw away a beautiful antique pencil drawing I had bought for Kate as a gift, and since then I diligently employ the unwrap, grab the wrap, bag the wrap method. Not a single piece of artwork or tin toy soldier has been lost since. After all the hubbub and the thrill of gift-giving had ended, and some adult relative who had come to stay was assembling a toy that I refused to assemble because I can't bear to read instructions, it was always our intention to loll around for a while in our pajamas, sip coffee, and watch the children short-circuit as they bounced from one toy to another. Every year, we imagined that these rare moments of repose were a possibility, as guests would not arrive for Christmas dinner until mid-afternoon. But every year, this never happened. Here is the reason why. There is a dish, a very special dish, that is served in our home on Christmas Day. It is called timpano. This is a baked drum of pastry-like dough filled with pasta, ragu, salami, various cheeses, hard-boiled eggs, and meatballs. It is a big, heavy dish, and needless to say, very filling. The recipe and the tradition of serving it on special occasions, particularly Christmas, were brought to America by my father's family. I never remember not having it on Christmas Day, whether we were celebrating at our home or at the home of one of my dad's siblings. It is quite a showstopper, so much so that we chose to feature it in Big Night as the centerpiece of the film's climactic meal. However, its preparation is very labor-intensive, and the cooking process requires much time and attention. It is for this last reason that, even though we would not be sitting down to eat until about 2 or 3 p.m., my parents would arrive at about 11 a.m. to begin the process of finishing the cooking of the timpano, which they had painstakingly assembled a couple of days before. Upon hearing the sound of car tires on the gravel drive and a moment later the shouts of Merry Christmas from my parents' mouths, I would sheepishly look at Kate. She would sigh quietly, and then, as she slowly turned and stared at me, I would see something die in her eyes. At this point, my anxiety level would skyrocket, and I'd flit off to the bar to see if I couldn't find liquid calm in a Bloody Mary or a Scotch sour. Laden with gifts and platters of food, even though we were cooking the dinner, my mother refused not to bring at least 3 extra side dishes, as well as any leftovers from the Christmas Eve dinner, from which we were all still recovering, because in her words, I'm not going to eat them, and God knows your father doesn't need them. Anyway, laden with gifts and platters of food, including the pièce de résistance shrouded in a large dishcloth, my elegantly dressed parents would climb the stairs smiling from ear to ear, as thrilled to see us as if we'd all been separated for decades, when in fact we had only just seen them the night before. They were so happy and excited, how could I even think of being put out by their extremely early arrival? Well, perhaps not so much me as my poor wife. I will tell you how. The timpano. First, let me give you the recipe so that you might acquaint yourselves with this traditional Tucci family fare. Timpano serves 12 to 16. The proportions may be adapted to fit a smaller or larger container. The dough for timpano is rolled out into a thin round, the diameter of which is determined by the pan you are baking it in. Add together the diameter of the bottom of the pan, the diameter of the top of the pan, and twice the height of the pan. The total will equal the approximate diameter needed. The dough may be kneaded in advance and set aside while you prepare the pan or refrigerate it overnight. Return it to room temperature before rolling it out. It is important to generously grease the pan with butter and olive oil before lining the pan with dough. Greasing and lining the pan with the dough may be done while the pasta is cooking. The meat used in the preparation of the ragu is generally served for dinner the night before the timpano is baked, because no one has room for anything other than salad after eating timpano. For the dough, 4 cups all-purpose flour, plus more for dusting, 4 large eggs, 1 teaspoon kosher salt, 3 tablespoons olive oil, 1/2 cup water. To prepare the pan, butter, olive oil. For the filling, 3 pound ziti, cooked very al dente, about 1/2 the time recommended on the package, and drained, 18 cups cooked. 2 tablespoons olive oil, 8 cups ragu tucci, at room temperature. 4 cups 1/4 inch by 1/2 inch pieces Genoa salami at room temperature. 4 cups 1/4 inch by 1/2 inch cubes sharp provolone cheese at room temperature. 12 hard-boiled eggs, shelled, quartered lengthwise, and each quarter cut in 1/2 to create chunks at room temperature. 4 cups little meatballs at room temperature. 1 cup finely grated pecorino romano. 6 large eggs, beaten. To make the dough, place the flour, egg, salt, and olive oil in the bowl of a stand mixer fitted with the dough hook. A large-capacity food processor may also be used. Add 3 tablespoons of the water and process. Add more water, 1 tablespoon at a time, until the mixture comes together and forms a ball. Turn the dough out onto a lightly floured work surface and knead it to make sure it is well mixed, about 10 minutes. Set aside to rest for 5 minutes. To knead the dough by hand, mix the flour and salt together on a clean, dry work surface or pastry board. Form the dry ingredients into a mound and then make a well in the center. Break the eggs into the center of the well and beat them lightly with a fork. Stir in 3 tablespoons of the water. Use the fork to gradually incorporate some of the dry ingredients into the egg mixture. Continue mixing the dry ingredients into the eggs, adding the remaining water 1 tablespoon at a time. Knead the dough with your hands to make a well-mixed, smooth, dry dough. If the dough becomes too sticky, add more flour. Set aside to rest for 5 minutes. Flatten the dough out on a lightly floured work surface. Dust the top of the dough with flour and roll it out, dusting it with flour and flipping the dough over from time to time to keep it from sticking to the work surface until it is about 1/16 of an inch thick and the desired diameter. Prepare the pan. Grease the timpano baking pan, a round enamel basin or casserole dish, very generously with butter and olive oil so that it is well lubricated. Fold the dough in 1/2 and then in 1/2 again to form a triangle and place it in the pan. Unfold the dough and arrange it in the pan, gently pressing it against the bottom and the side and draping the extra dough over the side. Set aside. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Make the filling. Toss the drained pasta with the olive oil and allow it to cool slightly before tossing with 2 cups of the ragu. Distribute 4 generous cups of the pasta over the dough on the bottom of the timpano. Top with 1 cup of the salami, 1 cup of the provolone, 3 of the hard-boiled eggs, 1 cup of the meatballs, and 1/3 cup of the Romano cheese. Pour 2 cups of the ragu over these ingredients. Repeat this process to create additional layers using an equal amount of each ingredient until they have come within 1 inch of the top of the pan, ending with 2 cups of ragu. Pour the beaten eggs over the filling. Fold the dough over the filling to seal completely. Trim away and discard any overlapping dough. Make sure that the timpano is tightly sealed. If you notice any small openings, cut a piece of the trimmed dough to fit over the opening, using a small amount of water to moisten the scraps to ensure a tight seal has been made. Bake until lightly brown, about 1 hour. Then cover with aluminum foil and continue baking until the dough is golden brown and the timpano is cooked through and reaches an internal temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit, about 30 minutes. Remove from the oven and allow to rest for 30 minutes to cool and contract before attempting to remove from the pan. The baked timpano should not adhere to the pan. To test, gently shake the pan to the left and then to the right. It should spin slightly in the pan. If any part is still attached, carefully detach with a knife. To remove the tympanum from the pan, place a baking sheet or thin cutting board that's large enough to cover the entire diameter of the pan on top of the tympanum. Grasp the baking sheet or cutting board and the rim of the tympanum pan firmly and invert the tympanum. Remove the pan and allow the tympanum to cool for 30 minutes more. Using a long, sharp knife, cut a circle approximately 3 inches in diameter in the center of the tympanum, making sure to cut all the way through to the bottom. Then, slice the tympanum into individual portions as you would a pie, leaving the center circle as a support for the remaining pieces. The cut pieces should hold together, revealing the built-up layers of great stuff. It is the inconstant cooking and resting times required of each individual tympanum made any given year that became the bane of Christmas Day. It is a temperamental dish, to say the least. It might take an hour or two to cook, then need to rest for an hour, or vice versa. It depends on the oven, the vessel it's cooked in, if the sauce it is made with is a little more watery than usual, if the tympanum has been previously frozen, etc., etc. That's all fine, if it's the only thing you are serving. But tympanum was served as a first course. Therefore, it was impossible to time the second course, like a leg of lamb or even a simple ham. People often wonder why, if there's such a huge first course, there is even a need for a second course at all. I have no answer for them. All I know is that it is traditional. It is very rare that one eats in an Italian home and both a primo and a secondo are not served on any given day. I remember the first time my brother-in-law John came to visit us in Westchester. My parents were over and my mother had cooked. She served the Tucci family ragu with pasta, followed by the ragu meat and meatballs. Obviously, finding it delicious, John kept going back for more. After a while, bowls and plates were cleared and new plates laid, at which point my mother brought a roast chicken, potatoes, 2 different vegetables, and a salad to the table. I noticed that John was suddenly a bit rattled. Confounded by what was basically another entire meal being placed before him, he politely asked, "Wow, wait, what's all this?" "What do you mean?" asked my mother, equally confounded by his query. "It's dinner." "Still?" he gawped. "I mean, well, what was that we just ate?" "That was just the first course," said my father, grinning devilishly. "Oh my God, I thought..." "You thought that was it, didn't you?" I asked. "Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I had 3 helpings." "I had a feeling you thought that was the main course." "Are you kidding? You can't just have that, especially on a Sunday," chastised my mother. Needless to say, we dug into the chicken and vegetables with gusto. 2 courses. It's just the way it has always been. And on holidays, both courses just get bigger. A lasagna, a bowl of pasta, or a soup as a first course is perfectly acceptable. But as I say, tympanum can cause issues both culinary and marital. How many over- or undercooked, not inexpensive pieces of meat were angrily eaten by Kate due to her inability to time them appropriately because of the tympanum, I cannot say. Not only were those legs or hocks lovingly prepared by her, but also they were what she was looking forward to eating because she didn't even like tympanum. It's sort of like cilantro. You either like it or you don't. I happen to love it. But even if the meal miraculously ended up being timed perfectly, the tympanum was so rich and heavy that the meat course could not be enjoyed to the fullest. At any rate, somehow we ate our way through just about everything most Christmases, but not without a lingering resentment deep in Kate's soul. I am, of course, being a bit harsh when I make it seem as though Christmases were ruined completely by an inanimate drum of pasta-filled pastry, but sometimes it came close. As I said, usually a ham or leg of lamb was served. The ham would be a large bone-in shank studded with cloves and a few pineapple rings and basted with a brown sugar glaze. It was then left to rest and served with potatoes, either roasted or au gratin, and string beans. If we were serving lamb, it was salted and drizzled with olive oil, and incisions were made with a small knife into which garlic and rosemary were inserted. A little white wine mixed with the meat juices made a light and savory gravy. The sweet smell of a leg of lamb roasting in the oven still brings back so many happy holiday memories for me. Throughout most of the world, lamb is eaten a great deal, but it seems to have fallen out of favor in America, and I'm not sure why, as it is delicious and can be cooked so many ways. The English and the Italians love lamb, and places like Australia and New Zealand are famous for theirs, yet perhaps the most delicious lamb I've ever eaten was in Iceland. I will address this in another chapter. After dinner, espresso, digestivi, fruit, nuts, dates, dried figs, biscotti, and lazzaroni amaretti cookies were served. These little almond-flavored rounds came wrapped in a delicate, crinkly, opaque paper. My father's favorite party trick was to roll the paper into a tube, stand it upright on the dinner table, and light the top of it on fire. If done properly, it would burn down evenly and, while somehow maintaining its cylindrical shape, just before the flame reached the bottom and singed the tablecloth, the now blackened paper would float high up into the air and almost, but never, touch the ceiling. What properties cause it to become aerodynamic when ignited are a mystery, but I know of no other paper in the world that has this ability. As kids, we begged my dad to do it over and over again, and he was more than willing to oblige, often to my mother's dismay. The reason being that there were a few instances when there was a failure to launch, and certain precious tablecloths still bear the scars. After dinner, dessert, and semi-drunken conversations about politics or something vaguely serious were attempted, the furniture was cleared to the edges of the living room and the ring game was played. This is a game of deception in which lying and cheating are encouraged. There are no teams and there is no winner. A ring is threaded onto a long piece of string, which is then tied together at the ends. A circle is formed by the players who hold the circle of string in both fists at waist height. One person is placed in the middle of the circle, whose goal it is to find out which player is hiding the ring. The person who has been found to have the ring then takes their place in the center. As soon as the game commences, all players begin sliding their hands in both directions, either pretending to pass the ring or actually passing the ring to the players on either side of them, shouting wildly things like, "Here, you take it, I don't want it," etc., etc. Needless to say, the poor person in the middle is slowly driven mad. The better you were at slipping the ring into the fist of the person next to you, and they are caught with it by the person in the middle, the less likely you were to end up in the middle. It is a cruel but brilliantly funny game, and as soon as you understand that cheating is not only necessary but fair, as it sometimes is in life, you will enjoy it. At the end of the day, when all the guests had gone and the children were tucked away after endlessly caterwauling about not being tired, Kate and I would end up having the inevitable conversation. It is important for you to know that this was a woman with the patience of a saint, a woman who seldom complained about anything. By the light of the Christmas tree, as I sipped a late-night scotch, the words, "that fucking timpano," would hiss from her lips, and a discussion about tradition, how not to insult family, or whether we should just go skiing over Christmas, etc., would ensue. However, I must admit that while the rest of the family slept, midnight often found me by the open refrigerator, eating a huge piece of timpano, and secretly thinking that for all its trouble, it probably was the best fucking Christmas gift of all. A Yule Epilogue. My wife Felicity Blunt and I started dating in the fall of 2010. Thrilling details await you in an upcoming chapter. And about a year or so later, she moved to Westchester to live with me and the kids. When Felicity spent her first Christmas with us, I was hoping she might take to timpano differently than Kate had. That didn't happen. What happened was exactly what I have described in the previous pages. I'm not kidding. Exactly. Pre-dawn, Christmas Day, parental arrivals, roasted meats brought to the table dry or charred like pathetic afterthoughts, the rolling of eyes, the gnashing of teeth by a woman who also has a saint-like patience, at the mere mention of timpano, and of course, the inevitable late-night conversation, beginning with the words, now uttered darkly in a posh British accent, "that fucking timpano." A Christmas cocktail. Here is my holiday version of a cosmopolitan. 1 tablespoon pomegranate seeds, 50 milliliters Ketel One vodka, 25 milliliters Cointreau, 25 milliliters cranberry juice, either unsweetened or cranberry juice cocktail, your preference, 25 milliliters pomegranate juice, ice, 1 raspberry, mint leaf, and fresh rosemary sprig to garnish. Put the pomegranate seeds into a shaker and muddle until muddled. Add the booze. Add the juices. Add the ice. Shake it. Strain into a coupe or a martini glass. Garnish with a raspberry wrapped in a mint leaf and skewered with a small stalk of rosemary. Drink it and have a happier holiday.